You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 95 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
And we weirdly have a lot to get to this week. We have the last ever dumpling bracket championship. This is for the non-soup dumpling region. Shortly, we will be crowning the non-soup dumpling region champion. We may, though, next week have
some more dumpling talk.
Some special dumpling talk.
Okay.
Not that all dumpling talk is special dumpling talk.
It
has a special place in our hearts, but we may have some special bonus dumpling content.
Some crossover dumpling content, wow. You might say. But that is next week, and this is this week. And what are we drinking this week?
This week we are talking about the Winter Olympics.
Yeah, it's going to be a special all-Winter Olympics
That is why we have a lot to get to.
We're going
to
be following Zach Whitman's live tweeting of curling. It's going to be great.
Wait, hold on. The U.S. now is at an 80% win probability.
Do they have curling win probability? Is that a thing?
Korea just went up 4 on Japan. Man, that is big news, I think.
I don't know how much 4 is in this context. No, I have a vague assessment. I have a vague understanding.
Did I tell you there was a...
curling is basically just bocce on ice.
I totally agree with you. As I explained it to my children, Drew Marjorie tweeted, he was like, big time dad move by explaining to my children how curling works when not knowing myself. And I'm like, I did that last night.
That is a classic dad move, because what are they going to tell me I'm wrong? I wouldn't roll that with me.
I'm unclear on whether you're shaving the ice to make the thing that you roll go faster or slower.
I think faster. I'm pretty confident faster.
I'm pretty sure it's slower. Well, that's what I told my children, so that's what they're going to think for the rest of their lives.
Oh, whoa. Let's not have another mishap as we try to open our alcohol this week. It was bad enough when we spilled last week. Also notable that... Oh,
2 weeks in a row. God damn. As we return from the new PeltonCast tradition of cleaning up the beer that I spilled when opening it.
And the other PeltonCast tradition of Mrs. Fantasy Genius listening to the podcast to find out why the kitchen table is sticking.
What are we drinking today?
We are drinking from Breakside Brewery in Portland. The Lunch Break ISA, India Session Ale. So a little lighter than an IPA. The little bit I tasted after it spilled out seemed quite sour.
Yeah, so I'm not going to lie. This smells bad. I like sour, but this does not smell good.
I'm going to see if it is as sour as it appeared at first.
It's not bad.
Okay, it is not. Yeah, it's sour aroma.
A strange nose.
Yeah, yeah. But that's drinkable. All right, we should not dally any longer. Or dilly-dilly. We should get right into talking dumplings. Well, for our last matchup in our search for Seattle's best dumplings, which has actually turned out to be the search for Seattle's best soup dumplings and Seattle's best non-soup dumplings, we are pleased to welcome back as third Pelton brother, someone who has eaten dumplings on multiple continents, loyal listener, friend of the pod, Nate Tager, welcome back.
Hey, thank you guys for having me. And Kevin, I just wanted to say I'm glad that you're still able to hear me after suffering through the Fergie national anthem.
We're going to discuss that later.
Okay, yeah, I don't want to spoil anything. I'm looking forward to your guys' description and conversation about that one. Must have been a real treat in person.
This has been like dumpling week for you, Kevin, right?
So I did dumplings. I mean, I haven't eaten more dumplings than usual because we only went to one of the two locations.
You eat
this week.
Fuckload of dumplings usually.
Exactly. Like, I was explaining it to someone at dinner tonight, and she was like, wow, you're eating a lot of dumplings.
Kind of build up the credentials.
I was like, look, that's a feature. That's not a bug.
But you have eaten dumplings a lot. Then you talked on the Bill Barnwell podcast about dumplings.
That's true.
In
the context of this podcast and our search.
It seems like that's generally the context. But then you were in LA and had dumplings in LA.
Yes. So dumplings are the favored meal when my podcast partners in crime, Kaylee Brain, Andrew Hahn, go eat lunch, and they are Din Tai Fung loyalists. So despite my pleas that we should go try to find some other dumplings somewhere in the entire city of Los Angeles, we went to Din Tai Fung in the suburb of Glendale, which was good from this standpoint. I got to have the Korean rice cakes.
How are they?
Not as good as the dumplings. They're good, but not as good as the dumplings.
Okay. How hard did you fight for other dumpling places? Did you pull up Yelp?
Well, so at one point we thought that former Third Pelton brother Mina Kimes might be joining us after she was on Around the Horn that day. She was unfortunately unable to make it, but had said that she was in if we went to Din Tai Fung.
Oh,
so that's why I acquiesced.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Well, that aside, speaking of dumpling credentials that you're building up, Nate, do you want to tell us your dumpling credentials?
Yeah. Like you guys said, I've eaten dumplings in Korea. That's about as far away as I've eaten dumplings outside of Seattle. Within Seattle, you know, I wouldn't say I have abnormal dumpling credentials. I've eaten at all the main spots, Din Tai Fung, Dozone. I did want to say I definitely would have chosen Din Tai Fung in the soup dumpling region.
Really?
Interesting.
Yeah. I don't know. I've been to Dozone one time, and I mostly remember what Cousin Katie said about it, how it's very cold in the Issaquah one. So.
You try the International District one. It's okay. Pleasant temperature.
Temperature-wise is much better.
Did you have the Cubao when you went? Do you recall?
I don't recall. This is probably 6 months ago, so I need to make a return trip. I'll go to the ID one this time.
Let me just say, if you would have had them, you would recall.
Okay, that's good to know. Or maybe I just had them and they're too cold or something. I don't know.
We did, as a follow-up, Mike B, who joined us previously as Third Pelton brother for both of the preliminary rounds of the non-soup doubling
Mike
region.
C, but okay.
Mike Carcino. he did finally get to Dozone last weekend and DM'd us, "My life will never be the same."
Oh, wow. Okay. Let me do a follow-up then, and hopefully I have the same result.
I'm curious. Once you do go there again, please let us know, because I'm very curious. I mean, it got the clean sweep Dozone over Din Tai Fung 4-0 last week. I'm curious what you think about that, Nate. But let's talk about the non-soup dumpling region. So this pits the number one seed Sichuan Noodle Bowl against the number two seed in the non-soup dumpling region, Dumplings of Fury. Nate, had you been to either of these places beforehand?
I had not, so I was very excited.
All right, tell us a little bit about your trips to both of them.
So last week, loyal listener Tyler and myself met up to go to Sichuan Noodle Bowl. And there we proceeded to order 56 dumplings between the two of us.
Amazing. Yeah.
I think it might be a personal record, but I'm not sure. That's the other thing I wanted to say about my dumpling credentials is that, you know, while I may not be the connoisseur and not know all the different types of dumplings and everything, I lose my goddamn mind when presented with a dumpling menu. So
that's a good credential.
What you may lack in quality, you make up for in quantity.
Absolutely.
Has Tyler never been a Third Pelton brother? Is he still a loyal listener?
He is not. We need to have him on some point during the burrito bracket. It's shameful, especially after he sent us the Rainier, Jubilee Rainier last year.
Oh, yeah.
Also, a shout out to Tyler for taking a photo of me and putting it on Instagram stories during the Husky game Thursday night.
I saw that.
It's a way of indicating that they were also there. So I went over and sat with Tyler and loyal listeners, Alicia and Lexi, for the first half of that game. And Tyler did go at one point to go get the Beecher's mac and cheese after I had it pregame. Ooh. All right, anyway, so Sichuan Noodle Bowl.
So, yeah, we ordered the 56 dumplings, which included pork and chive with the hot and spicy, the regular pork and chive, pork and napa. Is it just napa?
Yeah, I think that's napa cabbage.
Okay, that's right. Yeah, that's kind of what my Google research was telling me, but I wasn't quite sure. Dumplings with hot and spicy sauce, and the wontons with hot and spicy sauce. And then Tyler proceeded to get the wonton soup, so just more wontons in hot broth. I enjoyed everything. I will say that if you do go there, it's not worth wasting your time on anything that is not in hot and spicy sauce.
Really?
That's how I felt. Because everything we got in hot and spicy sauce, we also got the the plain version, and it wasn't even close. It wasn't, I mean, the hot and spicy sauce added all the flavor I needed. And after eating, you know, several of those dumplings, my plate was covered in that sauce, and I just proceeded to dump or rub my non hot and spicy sauce dumplings in it. So they all became hot and spicy sauce dumplings, and it made them all a lot better.
Yeah, I don't think we had a direct comparison, because we got the steamed dumplings were the only ones that we got kind of the hot and spicy. We got the wontons, which are slightly different, I think, in terms of how they're made. So we didn't get the head to head comparison, and we liked the steamed dumpling filling so much. We don't even know how good it would have been with the hot and
spicy. Oh my God. You got to go back and do the hot and spicy sauce. I mean,
I thought we dipped it in the wonton sauce.
The wontons are made with a different filling, not the our homemade ravioli style filling. The pork steamed dumplings.
We did several, since we had 56 dumplings to work with, I did several iterations of plain hot and spicy with the different types. And every single time I was just disappointed when I had to bite into the plain one versus the hot and spicy. Not to say it wasn't delicious. I thought the pork and chive dumpling that they had there was, that filling was excellent. It's just when you can get it with the hot and spicy sauce, I'm going to go that way every time.
Okay. And then what about Dumplings of Fury?
So Dumplings of Fury, I went there with another loyal listener, Alicia. And we didn't order 56 dumplings. We ordered some number less than that. But we did a sneak, took it over to Beer Junction. Is that what's next door?
There it is. That it is. Yeah. Yes. That's a sneak that I have not executed, but I've thought about many times.
We did the sneak. So there we got the shrimp and pork wontons, the shrimp and chive, which they said were their two best sellers, most popular.
Interesting.
Then the jumbo kimchi mandu. They were out of the barbecue pork humbao, which I was a little bit disappointed by.
I was wondering about that, since we didn't see it in the photo you posted. Yeah. That is a shame.
So we're going to have to make a return trip and do another sneak. But we did get the kalbi bao steamed buns, kind of like the sandwich style, which I think gave me a good representation of what they can do with that kind of bun. And I really enjoyed everything we had.
They are very different. The humbao is very similar, I think, to kind of the more traditional humbao, probably similar to what you had at Pike Place Market.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the other bao is kind of more of just a sandwich using bao is the bread, more or less. In more similar, I would compare it to the momofuku pork belly bao. So similar in style to that, although different fillings, of course.
Yeah, I thought the bao steam bun sandwich thing was really good. They do a good job. It's more meat. It's more. It definitely does not qualify as a dumpling, but
right.
I had to get something to fill in for the humbao part of it.
Right.
So I loved everything we had there. I hadn't really had a ton of pan fried dumplings in my life, and I thought the shrimp and pork wonton and the shrimp and chive were fantastic. I definitely could have ordered several more orders of those to fill out my 56 dumpling quota. The jumbo kimchi mandu was all right. It had a strange, kind of a strange flavor on the in the inside. I don't know if I'd get that again, but I don't know. When you compare Dumplings of Fury and Szechuan Noodle House, they're doing very different things. Like Szechuan Noodle House, I think we did the math. It came out to about 91 cents a dumpling. you could tell it's a great spot to go to lunch or happy hour, or I don't know, after work on Friday when you just want to eat a shit ton of dumplings. Dumplings of Fury was more, it felt more like a meal, more filling. They were much larger. You could tell they did a lot more, plating, putting, cilantro on it and the various different things.
They photographed really well, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And the sauces were delicious. I was doing the same thing, dumping all the sauces on all the dumplings by the end of it. I would be curious to know how you guys compare the two.
I'm so curious right now, because I feel like I have no idea what's going to win. It's going to come down to Kevin, I feel like. if I can read the tea leaves here.
Yeah, I mean, that's the direction it seems to be trending. let's talk first. So we did not go back to Szechuan Noodle Bowl due to time considerations, but I wanted to make sure that Tristan had a second opportunity, Dumplings of Fury, and specifically to try the bao that he did not have the previous time. And I had never had ordered the hum bao there.
How would you never order the hum bao? To me, that's number one thing I'm ordering.
I don't know. I
mean, man, God. It's so frustrating. Not gotta go
I
back.
Feel bad for you, Nate, that you went there and they're out. It was like, honestly, the first time I ever went to Dozone, they were out of soup dumplings. And so my feelings about Dozone, it's like, how do you not have soup dumplings? What did they run out of? Was it the soup or the dumplings? Which part? But
I don't know. I'm not going to go through the math here with you.
But so my feelings were a little bit worse about it. And I don't want you to have that perspective about Dumplings of Fury, because I think the bao is the best menu or the best item on the menu.
Hum bao. What did you think about the bao?
The hum bao or the bao?
The straight bao.
The little like pork sandwiches?
Yes.
They were fine?
Yeah, that's how I feel.
I thought the pork belly was really good.
Something about the way it was prepared just didn't quite do it for me.
It's interesting.
It was a little bit gristly, I felt like.
Huh. It's interesting because I had pork belly or pork. I'm sorry, not pork belly. I had, these are spare ribs is what I'm, short ribs are what I'm talking about here. I had that at both meals today, and I felt that the Dumplings of Fury was better than the one I had for dinner.
Okay.
Which where it was actually like the full main course.
It wasn't like fall apart fresh, you know, like it should
no,
be.
No, I agree with that.
It should be really soft and flavorful. And I felt like the flavor wasn't quite there. There also was still too much going on. I feel like Dumplings of Fury has to just take a step back and get to the basics of what they're doing. The other one that we had was basically a chicken strip inside of a little like pork bun, right?
Yeah.
That was the chicken one. I'm like, what?
You don't want that?
I don't want that.
I want that.
I'm so- But the hum bao, so I'm comparing the hum bao to Pike Place hum baos.
Which is not the name of it.
What is the name of it? Did you look it up?
I did look it up and put it in last week's post. I have subsequently forgotten it, so I will have to go look it.
Their name is Pike Place Market Hum Baos, though. Whatever their real name is.
Their name is actually Me Sum Pastry, for the record.
Have you ever had Pike Place Market Hum Baos, Nate?
I haven't. Tyler has actually been trying to get me to go for a long time, so this might be – eating all these dumplings has kind of got me in the mood to continue to eat a crap ton of dumplings, so maybe I'll make a trip there soon.
Tyler is positive.
Tyler is said it's the best hum bao in the world.
There it is. Best hum bao in the world. And that's what I'm saying. This is the standard that I have to compare the Dumplings of Fury hum bao to.
That's not the standard you have to compare it to.
The best hum bao in the world.
The standard you have to compare it to is Szechuan Noodle Bowl's dumplings.
Well, I'm just saying the thing is, I don't think the dumplings are that good. And I don't think the hum bao is as good as the best hum bao in the world. I'm just still trying to find the thing that makes Dumplings of Fury good.
All right, well, I've got a feeling that Nate might disagree. Do you have a winner in this matchup?
Yeah, so while I loved Szechuan Noodle Bowl, and I'll definitely be back to eat a lot, I thought what Dumplings of Fury was doing was just at a much higher level, and I enjoyed eating those a lot more than stuffing my face at Szechuan Noodle Bowl. So Dumplings of Fury.
Even from your description, I'm still taking – when you say stuffing your face, it's Szechuan dumplings.
Hey, when you can get 56 dumplings for 91 cents a piece, you know you're going to make a return trip.
I'm very in on that. And that's why I'm choosing Szechuan Noodle Bowl. So it comes down to you, Kevin. This is dumpling week for you. And now the dumpling spotlight is on you.
The dumpling chickens have come home to roost. I don't think that's an expression. So here's what I would say is that I think Szechuan Noodle Bowl had the best steamed dumplings of any steamed dumplings that we had in this entire competition out of all eight. I mean, we may not have had them at all eight. But here's the thing is steamed dumplings just aren't very good in general. So it's almost like, I don't know, being a really good middle reliever.
You just
like
said
that.
Steamed dumplings aren't that good in general. What are we even doing this search for, if that's your opinion?
Soup dumplings. That's what we're doing it for.
Yeah, this is like winning the AAA championship.
And also the bao. Those are what we're doing this for. So I think the Dumplings of Fury does a broader variety of things at a high level. You can go there. Nate didn't have the jalousie. I still think that now is my favorite thing on the menu after having it the last time. But there's plenty of options for you to choose them. I'm not as big a like the traditional humbao guy as I think most of the other people on the who have appeared on this podcast are, but that's a good option. You can go with their version of dumplings in hot and spicy sauce, and I think it's competitive with Szechuan noodle bowls, wontons in spicy sauce. So for that reason, for the variety, I'm going with Dumplings of Fury, which will be the winner of our non-soup dumpling bracket or region.
I will say I'm sorry that my horse lost, but the sneak of being able to go there and then go to Beer Junction is kind of worth it.
They had chocolate beer festival night, I guess, so we had a good time.
We had a good time. Do you want to talk about, Nate, you posted your beer list. So again, congratulations to Dumplings of Fury for being the non-soup dumpling region.
And congratulations champion. Once again to Dozone is Seattle's best dumplings. We decided we didn't even need to bother having another round of competition between the non-soup dumplings and the soup dumplings. The answer is clear. Dozone is Seattle's best dumplings. But if you want to try something that doesn't have soup dumplings, Dumplings of Fury is the place. Anyways,
congrats on winning the NIT Dumplings of Fury.
CBA champs.
I was going to go like Eastern Conference.
Nate, you posted this online, but you have a very extensive beers that you've drank spreadsheet.
Much more expensive than mine that I am keeping.
Yeah, I didn't expect that. Yeah, I don't know. Something I actually started and stopped it several times during previous years, and I kind of just like, and mine previously in previous years looked more like what yours looks like now, Kevin. But at the start of this year, I was just bored one day and kind of put together a spreadsheet and was actually doing a good job keeping it updated throughout the month of January when I seem to have been traveling a lot and drinking a lot more beer than normal. So
your spreadsheet was much more robust than mine was. It's a little bit of a, mine filled in a little last weekend at the All-Star game, but
you're very much in a safe space here, Nate.
Yeah, I hope so. You start every podcast with beer of the podcast.
Exactly.
How many beers are you at for the year?
Oh, I got it right here. Oh boy. Well, considering that I've done lots of tasters, please keep that in mind. I'm sitting at about 80 through February 20th.
I love it.
But that included a beer fest, Belgian beer festival, and included chocolate beer night during the dumpling sneak. You know, and Super Bowl, a trip to Whistler, a trip to the Fiesta Bowl. So a lot of beers this at the beginning of 2018.
Look, I don't know if you guys saw the headline. I know Third Pelton brother Danny Kelly did because he tweeted about it. Alcohol, the key to living past age 90, according to a study that nobody read anything but the headline of.
And you're going to live to 150. Do you rank the beers that you've had?
Some of them I put a rating next to if I really liked it. I don't know. It seems pretty inconsistent. I don't know if I'm going to continue that column. I have such a hard time. If I enjoy a beer, I enjoy a beer. If I don't, I don't. I'd rather just kind of classify them in that way.
Is there anything that you've had this year that you've particularly enjoyed, though?
Ooh. I'm just doing a quick scroll through here.
I can jump here to say that I think I had my best beer of 2018 earlier this evening at dinner.
Wow.
From Southern Tier Brewing, which I believe is New by York. The Krampus.
Yeah, they do the Krampus. And the Pumpkin.
Yes, that's right. I had a creme brulee stout of theirs, which was incredibly sweet, but not overpoweringly so, and was quite delicious. Tristan's upset. He wishes
shaking my head at you.
He wishes it was a cucumber sour beer.
I would say, if you haven't been to Structures Brewing in Bellingham or had any of their stuff, their Fuzz IPA, it's a hazy New England style IPA, I think is my favorite beer in a long time. And I've had several of those so far this year. So if you ever see it on tap, if you see can somewhere, if you find yourself in Bellingham, go to Structures, get Fuzz. It is delicious.
Really? This is a good recommendation because I've never heard of this brewery. Do you know anything about them?
It is fantastic.
I don't. I mean, I've never been to Bellingham in my life as part of it. At least the actual.
Oh, yeah. At least north of Northgate.
We like to call it Northergate. really Northgate. I like the idea that we would refer to all things. This being a Seattle-centric podcast, they refer to the distance of all things as how far they're from Northgate.
We'll have to keep an eye out for that, though.
I was definitely not of drinking age the last time I went to Bellingham.
It's close enough to Canada. You could sneak something up above the border, and you could have been 19.
That's quite a sneak.
Yeah. That's the ultimate sneak.
That's awesome, Nate. Well, thank you for coming on and sharing. I thought I had one more question about the beer. Oh, I had. So here's the question. This is more of a logistics question. I don't even know if this might even need to be taken out of the podcast. How do you handle it when you're keeping a beer list for the year, when you're, and maybe you don't do this, maybe this is only a me thing, when you're, let's say you're tailgating and you're drinking beer of mass consumption, right? Let's say that you're drinking 8 Rainiers. And you start losing track of how many Rainiers you've drank through that time period. How do you handle that situation?
So I put as many as I remember. I don't know. This thing hasn't made it to tailgate season yet, so we'll see.
Okay.
I used to use Untappd, you know, the app, and I would if I mean, you guys know because you visit our tailgate. We have a keg hidden in a location that I won't say publicly at our tailgates. So usually I would just check that beer in one time and then mark down that I got it from a keg.
Okay.
But if I were drinking several Rainiers, I'd, you know, put a couple down or something.
I mean, to me, the quantity is less important than just knowing what beer you've had. And then in my case, I think the rating is important, although I agree that it's kind of more of a pass fail than it is really like ranking the beers in order somehow.
Well, it's hard to remember like exactly.
Like a dunk contest grade, kind of.
Oh, God. We're going to talk about that later.
Because I just want to know, did I like this beer? Should I order it again or not? That's, to me, the big reason for maintaining the spreadsheet.
Yeah, same here. I was inspired by your end of year in beer report on the podcast. And I'd used Untappd, like I said before, and I didn't think I was actually like coming away using that, knowing what I had actually had throughout the year. I was just checking into things. And so this is easier for me to kind of see and keep an eye on beers that I can look forward to next year.
I'm impressed. Well, for me, at the beginning of the night, the ranking gets a DJ Khaled ranking. And then the last beer gets a Chris Rock ranking.
I just want to say again, the Pelton cast out here changing lives.
Now people know I've had 80 beers and like 80 dumplings since the start of the year.
And they're envious. On that note, thanks so much for joining us and helping us conclude the search for Seattle's best dumplings.
Hey, thank you guys. Thanks for having me.
This is also going to go over poorly with Mrs. Fantasy Genius, isn't it?
She'll be fine. I'm just not going to tell her.
Okay, good.
Yeah, she doesn't actually listen to this podcast.
And how did she find out about the beer spilling last, or the cider, I should say, spilling last week?
It was a fluke.
Okay.
So we've wrapped up our bracket for Seattle's best dumpling. Dozone, the clear winner, the clean sweep in 4 games, 4-0, the champion. If you haven't been to Dozone, I recommend you get there as soon as possible.
Not because of the fact that like you need to go because it might close or something. Just because...
No, the locations are rapidly opening.
You want to live in a world where you have eaten Dozone rather than a world where you have not eaten Dozone.
There's going to be a Dozone on every corner in the future.
Starbucks style, 2 possibly on the same corner. What's next for us?
But now we have to turn our attention to, you know, the summer is coming, can't you tell?
Yeah, the snow flurries today were a great sign that summer is on the way.
We have to turn our attention to our search, not bracket. We're kind of refining the way that we're looking at food each time. Our search for Seattle's best burrito.
So we're going to wait a few weeks here. You don't know this, but I've decided this.
You're going to Boston.
Until after the end of the Husky men's basketball season.
I think that's a lot of weeks. I mean, it's going to go through when the Sweet 16, the Elite 8, the final, and then the championship game. So
I mean, it's still only April. It'll give us plenty of time to search for burritos. I think it makes sense to hone our focus in on Husky Ben's hoops for the next few weeks here, and then turn our attention to burritos. But that also
Can
gives
I still
us plenty
recreationally
of time.
Eat burritos.
Of course, going to stop you from doing that. That also gives us time to solicit suggestions and feedback from you, the listener. Number one, about where we should go in our search for Seattle's best burrito. But number two, and possibly more importantly, should we be strictly searching for Seattle's best burrito?
Oh, really?
Because there's a lot of qualms about, well, what about tacos?
What about tacos? Katie was the first one to bring this up to me.
She was. Tacos and burritos.
Was it Voice of the People, famous cousin Katie, was the
that
first one
true.
To bring
and
this up
this
to me.
This is everything else. Tacos and burritos are, some would say, is interrelated as bao and dumplings.
Wow. Some have said that. Just you now.
I think I'm the first person to draw that conclusion in the history of the world. But I don't know. Should we put them in separate brackets? Should we put them all together in the same bracket and just go with whatever is best?
Are we doing a search or are we bracketing these things?
Or we're doing a search that will culminate in a bracket.
Okay.
In late summer, early fall, leading into the start of the football season.
Oh my God, that's a long time from now. My question for you is, this is an interesting way of looking at it. Because if I ask you right now, what is the best burrito in Seattle?
I mean, that's why we're doing the search. But my favorite would be Tacos Chuki's.
What's the best taco in Seattle?
Also Tacos Chuki's.
Okay. So that's the issue that we find ourselves at right now.
I mean, I think you would say that only one food item from each restaurant would be eligible. It's just a question of whether we can expand the search to consider a place like, what was the place we were looking at? Rocket Taco?
Never heard of it. Wait, were we looking at Rocket Taco?
I think we were. I just can't remember if that's the correct name of the place that we were looking
that
at.
Doesn't
that recently
sound like a
opened
place that I'm interested in
on Capitol Hill.
And Rocket Taco?
Strictly do tacos. Yes, that is correct. It's in the old Kingfish Cafe location.
I've never heard of this place, but to me, it's just a Tacos Chuki's ripoff.
It is not. That's very different.
Okay, so here's my question for you: is what if, rather than, we've structured these in different ways. We've done a straight bracket
for
dumplings.
It appears the U.S. has won their curling match.
Oh my God!
That's my interpretation of
that.
Stop Zachary's
everything. That's the best burrito in Seattle. What if, this is groundbreaking stuff, you're just hearing about this for the first time. What if instead of doing a search for Seattle's best taco or burrito, we do a search for, is there any taco or burrito that is better than Tacos Chuki's?
So it's not bracket style thing.
We establish the top, right? And say, does this every single taco and burrito that we have will be compared to the clear best burrito and taco in Seattle, in our opinion? But we haven't had every burrito and taco in Seattle, right? There are numerous tacos and burritos we haven't had.
So is this a pass-fail system? Or do we still give a grade? A rating.
We still give a grade and a rating, but maybe if something tops Tacos Chuki's, all of a sudden the competition is, is there any burrito or taco that's better than Taco Place X?
So it's like a championship belt of tacos.
It's a taco championship belt or a burrito championship belt.
Someone please mock that up in Photoshop, perhaps Cousin Katie. All right, anyway, we've got some more time to think about this.
Anyway,
so
do you like
suggestions.
This idea?
I do like this idea.
The listener, do you like this idea?
Let us know at peltoncast@gmail.com for those of you who are not on Twitter. And we look forward to hearing from you. And now, instead of looking forward to the future of our search for who can knock off Tacos Chuki's,
are we doing that? Have we established that?
I think we have. Let's look back to the past, and specifically just last weekend and my trip to the All-Star Game in Los Angeles. What do you want to know?
Okay. I want to start. There are a few things that I want to know. First, before we get into the meat of the situation, which is Rob Riggle, I want to first talk about the food that you ate in L.A.
So I would say it's a shocking number of my LA trips have been. It was not a trip that was predicated on eating, but Saturday was more strictly focused. So on Friday, I just had lunch outside the ESPN offices in the middle of doing various things there.
Where are the ESPN offices?
Literally right next to the Staples Center.
Oh.
Which would be fun if I were ever there when an NBA or even a WNBA basketball game was being played. But so far, that has not been the case.
I have no idea where the Staples. I've been to LA multiple times and have never so much seen the Staples Center.
So it's the LA Live area.
What city is that in? It's in LA.
Technically, it falls under downtown. So Friday night after the game, the players, I believe, were staying at the Four Seasons Hotel, which is like the upper floors of the JW Marriott that is like also within the same complex.
The cool people just call it the JW.
Yes. Do they?
No. At South by Southwest, people are like,
oh, I'm at the JW.
Where are you at? They're I'm at the JW. And I'm like, man, this seems like a really cool new hotel. I'm like, God, the JW, that's where I want to be. And I'm like, oh, it's the Marriott.
No, I mean, the JW Marriott is it's a fancy Marriott.
Okay.
Anyways, so because players were staying in there, you could only get in with credentials. Mm. So it turned out to be a great place to go because we were able to get in with our media credentials. And we went to a Wolfgang Puck, like, Asian restaurant in there. I mean, I know it was just close.
What is this, an airport? Well,
but anyways, while we were there, we saw Giannis was there, as well as Mike Wilbon, and the food was perfectly solid.
Okay. Did you have any good food in LA?
Saturday, like I said, was the day for eating. So for brunch, the number one thing I was planning to do in LA, the number one goal I had this weekend, was to go to get the Burmese food that Rich Cho talked about on this very podcast.
Did you? This is the Burmese food that's like in a house, right?
In a backyard.
All right, Peter Rich Cho. Sorry.
Well, we'll get to that in a second.
Wait, that's going
to
be part of this?
Vaguely. So my good friend Kevin Arnovitz, my ESPN colleague, has been there a couple of times and took me and Ross Marinson, an editor for ESPN the magazine, and we went out there and we tried so their version of khao soi, the Northern Thai dish that is a coconut noodle soup with that's probably one of my favorite items in the world to eat.
Okay.
There was also a fish soup, whose name I now forget, a chicken noodle dish, and then we had tea leaf salad, which is sort of the Burmese specialty.
Okay.
So I'm comparing this only to Burma Superstar, which is the only other Burmese food.
I mean, I also want to hear how the khao soi compares to pok bok.
Better.
It was better than pok bok.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I would say that, I mean, it's definitely not, it's not a restaurant setting. It's not as polished as something you would get in a restaurant. But the chicken in these dishes was better and more tender, I would say, than what I am used to at a pok bok or a Burma Superstar.
What is the setting like? Is it in somebody's house?
It's not in. It's in the backyard. It's like
it's in the backyard of somebody's house?
Yeah. And there's like a cover over it. You walk in through an alley. It is exactly as lo-fi as described.
Wow. Was Giannis there?
Giannis was not there. I don't know how much Burmese he speaks. Most of the ordering there, it seems, is conducted in Burmese.
Okay.
So this is how authentic.
And Kevin Arnovitz is fluent in Burmese.
He's not, but he knows enough of what he needs to know to get everything ordered.
Man.
And they did speak English as well.
You are lucky to have Kevin Arnovitz around, though, for your food tourism.
Oh, yeah. He was a tremendous food guy.
He's your food tourism angel.
He's my food Sherpa in this case.
There we go.
So that was great.
Yeah, I'm very. I did not know you went there. I'm excited about this.
Yeah, I don't think I told you. A few hours later, as we were coming back from the Basketball Without Borders event at the Lakers practice facility, Danny LaRue of Real GM and The Athletic was nice enough to give me a ride.
Dunked On podcast.
Yes, that too.
Cap space.
Of course. It was nice enough to give Jonathan Charks of The Ringer and I a ride back. And Jonathan asked,
it's just a name dropping,
if we could get burgers before the game.
Charks asked this?
Yeah.
He just moved up a lot of notches in my book.
So lo and behold, right down the street from the Lakers practice facility, it turns out, is one of the two In-N-Outs located near LAX.
Yes.
So we stopped there.
How did I not see this on the internet?
You're right. I did not tweet about it.
You're at In-N-Out. I feel like this is like, you're part of Seahawks Twitter. You need to post every single time you go to In-N-Out.
That is actually.
And you need to try to compete with Ben B for how many burgers you had.
No. Because I had just eaten the large Burmese meal hours earlier.
Imagine how impressed you were with Charks and Danny LaRue. Imagine how impressed they would have been if you would have ordered four double-doubles animal style.
Danny did tell us that at one point. We've had Nate on to talk about In-N-Out. We have not had Danny yet. He told us that at one point his standard order was a 4x4.
Yes.
Isn't that great?
That's wow. We need to have Danny on board for a standard order as a 4x4. Does he think the bun is a tour de force?
I don't think he's as poetic in describing it as Dane is. Sadly, we all just had double doubles. So we introduced Charks to Animal Style. He has never previously
eaten Animal Style. Does he live in L.A.?
He does not live in L.A., okay. But he lives in Dallas where they do, in fact, have In-N-Outs.
He had never heard of Animal Style?
I don't know if he hadn't heard of it, but he didn't know for sure that he was supposed to order it that way. So, you know, again, we're out here changing lives. We
need some oxygen here. Jesus.
So I just had a double-double Animal Style and a Neapolitan shake.
No animal fries?
Again, he'd eaten hours earlier. So this, I figured, was going to be my last
ben
food
Ben
of the
would
day.
Say that I'm wasting space with the animal fries.
He would say that. He would also say that he's disappointed with me for only ordering the one burger.
I'm personally disappointed in you, but I'm just saying you should have just ordered four burgers and then just posted it on the internet.
I mean, I guess I could have posted all three of our orders together, and maybe that would have worked.
It still would have been unimpressive.
And then,
so wait, what was Charks's review though? Did you sit and eat it at the In-N-Out?
He got it. No, we ate it in the car as we were heading back to the All-Star Game, or the All-Star Saturday Night.
He got it.
He got it.
Okay,
he was in.
Okay,
yeah. So we won him over.
Man, I'm impressed with his request for eating burgers.
Yeah, after the game Saturday night. We're looking again for a place to eat nearby near the Staples Center and went to the original Pantry Cafe.
Okay.
A place that is located a couple blocks away and is notable for their open 24/7, claimed never to have been closed or without a patron at any point since they opened in, it's open since 1924. So I don't know if it's that entire time, but at least a very long time.
Wow.
And there's usually, I had tried to go here for breakfast when I was in L.A. in June because of the fact that it was, one block away from the hotel.
Who
were
you with
staying
for this one?
Again, Daniel LaRue, Dan Feldman of NBC Sports, Matt Moore of Action Network, Action Network, and Sam Vecini of The Athletic.
Okay.
So
it's a little bit less name-droppy of a group of people.
So usually there's a huge line there in the morning. There wasn't much of a line because it's kind of a breakfast. It specializes in breakfast, although they serve dinner food as well. So we were able to get in there. And even though I had eaten so much, I still split an order of pancakes and had those just to say I'd eaten there.
Where do you stand on the pancakes for the table?
Order it and then everyone, as an appetizer, basically?
Kind of. But so
to go along with each of your meals?
Nobody wants just pancakes. Everybody wants all the other things, right? You're not familiar with this concept, pancakes for the table?
I'm not, no. Not
wow,
not.
I'm changing your life here. Mm-hmm. It's basically everybody orders their own individual items, whatever. You have your eggs benedict, omelets, things like that. Various egg dishes.
Crab rangoon and things of that nature.
But then you order, because everybody wants a little bit of pancakes.
Yeah, yeah.
Nobody wants all the pancakes, right? And usually pancakes are too big, especially if it comes in a stack or whatever. So you order pancakes for the table. Everybody splits it up into fourths or whatever.
Okay. I'm in on that. I mean, you know my theory about chicken and waffles, right?
No.
That the reason chicken and waffles are great is because of the fact that I both want savory and sweet for breakfast. Mm-hmm. And it allows me to combine them in one order.
Okay.
That's my theory on chicken and waffles. Anyway, so that was kind of it as far as notable dining.
I'm looking to see if anybody's talked about pancakes for the table on Google. If I Google pancakes for the table, how much is going to come up?
That was sort of it as far as notable dining. Obviously, as mentioned earlier, on Monday we went to Din Tai Fung, which the menu appears to be virtually exactly the same as it is in Seattle. So I learned nothing necessarily besides, again, having the opportunity to eat the Korean rice cakes for the first time.
Apparently somebody named Lisa Traeger on Late Night with Seth Meyers said, pancakes for the table. That's a power move.
Oh, okay.
So anyway, if you're looking for a power move courtesy of somebody named Lisa Traeger.
All right.
Got one. Okay, okay, All-Star Saturday Night. Let's start there.
Yeah. You don't want to talk about the Rising Stars Challenge?
Oh, sorry. Okay, Friday night, right? The celebrity game. You were there?
I did not attend the celebrity game because I wasn't sure how to get there.
I'm telling Wynn Butler about this. where was it? It wasn't at Staples Center?
It was at the Convention Center. Oh. They play them at separate locations because they're immediately back-to-back the celebrity game and the Rising Stars Challenge. Okay. And I was actually specifically covering the Rising Stars Challenge, so that was my main focus. Mm. I would have liked
did
to
you
have
do grades for the celebrity game?
No.
People would have loved to have read grades for the Celebrity Game.
I'm sure they would have.
Man, I'm pretty disappointed.
Someone else at one point did grades for the Celebrity Game. I don't think I saw them this year.
As far as I can tell, Quavo's a pretty good basketball player.
Yeah, not bad.
When I watched maybe highlights of the Celebrity Game. Maybe I was watching for a few minutes on Friday.
I also didn't realize Nate Robinson was playing until after the fact.
It feels weird to me that they have old players, because I'm like, you're not a celebrity, you're a basketball player.
I mean, it's just kind of a mixing of
groups. Can they not fill it out with celebrities?
No, I think, apparently they had a tough time because there was a competing Celebrity Game. I don't know if you heard that.
What?
Adidas was putting
on this. Did Black Dre put it together?
Adidas was putting together a game of exclusively rappers. And so they had bigger rap names than the Celebrity
Game. Who did they have?
I mean, like, it was Snoop Dogg. One was one team. Snoop Dogg was...
Team Snoop.
It was like he was the Steph Curry of that game.
Who was the LeBron of that game, though?
I do not remember.
It better
that
be Gucci Mane.
Off my head.
Not J.R. Ryder, as far as you're concerned.
Yeah.
Okay, so the Rising Stars Challenge. I did not pay attention to this at all.
You don't need to. It was fine.
I didn't even know it was happening.
2 Chainz was the other captain.
Oh, man. You should have been at that game.
That was happening directly opposite the Rising Stars Challenge.
What, why are you at the Rising Stars Challenge? Nobody cares.
That's where it was.
Okay. All right. Fine.
That's what I was graded.
Okay. Let's move on to All-Star Saturday Night. You did, because it's only Rising Stars on Friday, right? And the Celebrity Game, which you were not at.
Yes.
Okay. So All-Star Saturday Night, they start with the Skills Challenge. It's the Lauren Marketing coming out party.
Was it that?
I don't know. I had watched it much later.
Yes, I did grades for the Skills Challenge.
Oh, God.
They're the most ridiculous of all the grades, obviously.
Did you do predictions for all these?
I did, yes.
How did you do in your predictions?
I predicted that... Who did I predict was going to win the... I think Joel Embiid maybe to win the Skills Challenge. I picked a big man because the big men have won the two since they've been eligible.
Wow, terrible pick.
But not this year. Spencer Dinwiddie got the win.
3-point shootout. Devin Booker breaks the record.
I mean, sort of.
You're not impressed?
Well, there was this. They added the second Moneyball rack in 2014, so the scores are all way higher.
There's two Moneyball racks?
I'm sorry, they added the full Moneyball rack, I should say. Before, you just had the one Moneyball on each rack, but now there's a full rack of them, so you can score 34 instead of 30.
So there's point inflation.
Yes. Okay. Craig Hodges made more in a final
round. I was going to say, was it Craig Hodges?
It was Craig Hodges.
That's like by far his claim to fame.
But it was still a very impressive round of shooting by Devin Booker after a pretty dismal first round.
Okay, so
Paul George got booed.
He did bad.
He got.
I was one of the people booing him. I was booing when he came up to start shooting.
He got the only F of the weekend.
Oh wow!
Yep,
the only F of the weekend.
Yep.
The Minnesota Timberwolves Chicago Bulls trade grade of the weekend.
Oh, no, I think that would mean he was going to win next year's 3-point contest.
Yeah, people need to revisit that trade grade because Jimmy Butler didn't even show up to the All-Star game.
He was there. He showed up. All right, Sunday.
So the dunk contest. Do I want to talk about the dunk contest for a second?
Yeah.
It was bad.
It was fine.
The dunk contest. How many dunk contests have you been to?
Four?
What was the best one that you've ever been to?
Four.
Do you
the best one was Aaron Gordon and Zach LaVine.
And that was fun.
Yeah.
Do you think the celebrity judging mattered? Like I'd see the grades and I'm like, every single, if a person completes a dunk that is semi-interesting on the first attempt, they're going to get like a 48 or a 50.
This was the first year I thought the judging was really problematic. I mean, not necessarily because of who it was, just in terms of everything is a 9 or a 10.
I know this is insane, but I want much harder grading on the dunk.
Apparently you're not allowed to give lower than a 6.
Wait, really?
Yeah, apparently that's what the rules state. That's what I heard from Dan Feldman. So, I mean, that's kind of similar to how our burger ratings ended
up. You gave the Costco burger a 50.
I guess that's true. That's lower than would be possible.
Were there any dunks that impressed you?
Dennis Smith, I thought, had the best dunk of the night.
Which was that?
It was coming out of bounds, and he went between his legs and dunked it, going away from the basket, I think.
I feel like a lot of it is just like wearing the jersey of former dunk contest participants.
Yes.
Or jumping. I mean, honestly, when it was it Donovan Mitchell who ended up, he missed his first attempted dunk and then he gathered people together, right?
I mean, that was a smart play because like if you're going to miss the first dunk, don't just do it over again.
Yes, you got to go with the only dunk. That's what I feel too. Is you need a backup option. It was just a little bit hard to get excited about almost any of the dunks.
But that's usually the case. The dunk contest is just not that good.
Yes, I think the dunk contest needs to go away for a while. Okay, so then we get to, do you agree with that assessment?
I don't know if it needs to go away. I think just people need to recalibrate their expectations. Like, things can exist that are not that good.
We need to regress.
For example,
we need to regress our excitement about the dunk contest to the mean. Got it?
For example, this podcast should continue to exist.
Wow. Okay, so Sunday rolls around.
Yeah.
You're there pregame. Walk us through the feeling and the temperature in the room, especially during, before we get to Fergie, the introduction that just keeps going.
Yeah. The Rob Riggle, Kevin Hart stuff went over pretty flat.
Who is asking for Rob Riggle? Like, what is his career based off of?
I mean, I don't have any issue with Rob Riggle specifically. I just don't know that we need, like, sketch comedy or, like, any elaborate, like, coordinated thing before the All-Star game.
People talk about all the successes of the Adam Silver tenure. People need to look at this a little bit more.
take a closer look. And then when Kevin Hart was actually doing the introductions of the players, I mean, a big thing to note is, like, within the arena, the PA system is a little, I don't want to say bad, but it's unclear. So you couldn't even hear most of what Kevin Hart was saying.
Oh, really?
And I was honestly just reading during this.
Were you reading? You also came to, like, the you had Shay's book in front of you. You're just flipping through it.
Yeah.
Were you reading? No, I honestly want to know.
Just on the internet. I was catching up on my reading for the weekend.
It's too bad that Husky basketball wasn't playing. You could have just been totally consumed by that.
I did stream that on Saturday night.
It's much more interesting than the dunk contest.
So the other thing is you can't, like, the most of the media seating is behind the stage because of the fact that they don't want to put paying customers in those seats where you can't see any of the entertainment.
Uh-huh, sponsors, you mean.
So instead, we were not seeing any of the entertainment.
Tickets that were included with the activation.
There's a lot of activation. Everything's an activation. So
just wait till I go to South by Southwest and talk about that in a couple weeks.
Yeah. So, you know, and it dragged on so long that people were just really ready for it to be done.
Really kept going. I was like, children, you could play video games till like 5:15. And I was like, oh, actually, you could play video games till like 5:45 because this basketball game is never going to start.
I think it might have tipped at 5:40.
Jesus Christ. Okay, so what was the mood during the Fergie anthem?
I don't think I noticed the mood in the room being that off until, like, she paused late in the rendition. This is about when Jimmy Kimmel shows up on the screen a little after Draymond Green.
Yeah.
And then I don't even know if I can describe the sound that was made, but it was unpleasant. It's not what you want to hear if you're a performer.
I'm just so jealous that you got to be in the room for one of the worst anthems ever.
I was at dinner earlier, and it was the one thing that engaged the entire table. Was like, you were there for that anthem? I'm like, yeah, years from now.
I witnessed it.
People are going to talk about that Fergie anthem.
They should have Fergie do the anthem every year and just cancel the dunk contest.
My take was that at least anytime the All-Star game is in L.A., they should just play the Marvin Gaye anthem that he did at the 83 All-Star game at the Forum. And just, if you want to use, like, the holographic technology that they didn't use with Prince at the Super Bowl and use that to recreate Marvin Gaye.
Marvin Gaye never called holograph technology creepy because it didn't exist.
Exactly. There you go. So just run that back every time they're in LA and don't have an actual live anthem. The other notable thing that happened in the arena that I don't know if you could tell on television, probably couldn't, is the legendary Lakers PA announcer Lawrence Tanter referring to bare naked ladies as bare necked ladies.
Oh,
yeah. Is that Canadian pronunciation? Is that a thing?
I don't think so.
I don't.
But I did also explain to my children who bare naked ladies were.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
That and curling.
It was an important cultural moment for them. Yeah. So then most of the game happens, right? Let's fast forward to.
By the way, I don't know how it played on TV, but in arena, there was not much response during the first half.
Really?
For all the talk of players playing harder. Like, there were not enough highlights.
I feel like that's probably true. It was kind of just like a basketball game that, okay, players shooting threes is great, but it's not actually that compelling.
Well, it's not compelling if they miss all their threes.
Well, that too.
They were shooting a really low percentage. Now, it turns out in past years, they actually have shot a fairly low percentage on threes. Two, it's just the game has been so fast-paced, and there's such a high percentage on twos that they still scored almost 200 points last year.
But that there are occasional highlight dunks and things like that. I still don't think those are that exciting, though, the highlight dunks. To me, what I want to see in an All-Star game is I want to see players who we don't see playing against each other very often doing something unique.
Right.
And I think that's what we got at the end of the game.
I mean, here's the thing is that I think makes it tough to judge whether the new format, quote, worked, is, like, most All-Star games are bad. The only time, like, everyone freaking out about...
Most All-Star games are bad in most sports.
Yeah, but everyone freaking out about the last 2 years. Like, yes, it got to be more like the Rising Stars game in terms of the defense level, but it's not like there was a lot of defense.
Has anybody said that it's like the Rising Stars? I think that's only a you could be like... most people are comparing it to the Celebrity game, but you missed that! Jerry Ferrer's lockdown defense was noted in many places.
He's getting ready for that matchup with Black Tri. But the reason people remember past All-Star games fondly is they remember times when it was close and guys played hard in the last 5 minutes.
Yes.
And that definitely happened.
That's all that matters. I was worried about that. Because all we really care about... The thing is, if it would have been more of a blowout... Because my perspective was that Team Steph was going to blow out Team LeBron.
I thought they would win. I didn't know if they were going to blow them out.
They were teetering for a moment.
Yeah.
And then Team LeBron turned it on a little bit sooner than Team Steph did.
I'm not sure Team Steph ever turned it on. Like, Steph's out here throwing like a 30-foot pass over his head in the last 3 minutes of the game.
It was a little bit surprising.
Seems odd, except that he also did that in, I mean, not that distance, but he did that in Game 7 of the NBA Finals. So that's just kind of how Steph is wired, which is different than LeBron. And this time again, LeBron's team emerged victorious.
So you're saying that Steph doesn't have another level?
I'm not saying that Steph doesn't have another level. I'm saying that Steph, he just can't, like, take away the joy of basketball.
God.
To his credit,
that's like saying, like, you know, my biggest weakness is that I work too hard. It's like Steph in the biggest moment just can't take away the joy of basketball.
But he turns the ball over too much, and it drives Steve Kerr crazy. Steve Kerr was on a beach somewhere, I guarantee it, and he just like felt like this disturbance in the force.
Steph Curry has too much joie de vie.
I think that's pronounced joie de vie, isn't it?
Scholars are divided. Anyway, so what was the mood like in the last couple minutes, though? Could people feel that it was getting to be a competitive game?
Yeah.
And were people excited? Because, I mean,
they were.
I was dialed into that game at that point. This was like Warriors Blazers from the night before or a few nights before.
Yeah,
I was locked in.
It was edge of your seat stuff. The crowd, still the largest cheer of the night for the crowd was when Michael Jordan came out.
They showed Kobe Bryant on.
No, they didn't show Kobe, I don't think.
Was he there?
I'm sure he must have been.
God,
but
he would have gotten a standing ovation from the Staples crowd.
Oh, for sure. There were so many Kobe jerseys in the crowd. I felt like out of place. But anyway, Jordan comes out to like ceremoniously receive the honor of hosting the All-Star game from Jeannie Buss and Steve Ballmer as this year's hosts, which is weird because it's like very like the Olympics.
Oh, because he's hosting it next year? Next, are they going to do Team Kobe and Team LeBron even though they're not playing? Both with Charlotte ties, right?
They are, wait, what?
For next year.
LeBron?
Sorry, Team Jordan and Team Kobe for next year. That's what they should do.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to do that. No, it's just going to be whoever the captains are who can't be LeBron and Steph because you can't repeat. By the way, I forgot to say, while we're on the topic of Charlotte, I was going to point out that I did hear that Rich Cho was scheduled to go to that place on Sunday. So it was like his last act as Hornets GM was going to get even.
That was his last meal.
Yeah.
I mean, he's still alive, for the record.
Yes, we'll continue.
Rich Cho is totally fine.
Surely continue his career. I mean, it's sad, but yeah.
Okay, so people were excited. The last moments happened. I honestly wanted more basketball.
I wanted overtime, yeah.
I was really hoping. You know, I was hoping they'd hit a three and go to overtime and have that same level of intensity for another 5 minutes.
That would have been amazing. I mean, at some point, they might have ran out of that energy because you've partied all weekend.
But there's a lot of players on the team. They didn't need to play in those
five players. They could have put in Dame Lillard at some point.
So he played well. I was paying like 40% attention for most of the game until the end.
I mean, he tied for the team high with 21 points.
Really?
And he was like a plus like 18 or something in plus minus.
Good for Dame.
Yeah.
So he was out there balling when nobody else really was.
He had a legit chance at MVP at one point.
But they took him out for the end.
Mm-hmm.
Was Paul George in there?
No. The fivesome on the court at the end was...
But he was in there through like crunch time.
No.
I thought George was in there.
Steph, James Harden, DeMar DeRozan, I don't know, I'm blanking on their front court now. Joel Embiid and Anthony Davis was the fourth.
Embiid was good.
Yeah, Embiid was great.
That was also a fun stretch, the Embiid-Russell stuff.
Yeah.
I thought that was good. It was a good All-Star game, right?
It was, yeah, no, I think it was probably the best All-Star game I attended. I think it, I'm not sure what the previous winner was, which says something about how important they were or how good they were, but this is the new winner.
Okay, so my last question about the weekend
was
bringing it back to Seattle focus. Was there any scuttle, were there any conversations happening while you were there about NBA to Seattle?
So it's interesting. There's been a lot of expansion talk lately. Brian Robinson wrote a piece about that on Sonics Rising. And then Bill Simmons in the BS podcast you recorded on Monday mentioned that he thinks that it could kind of be one way to offset the concerns of the Players Association that if you lower the age limit to 18, you're taking jobs away from veterans. Which is
Doesn't that actually change anything? I mean, how many players does that affect? A few?
In terms of the... I mean, yes, but more than none is the answer.
Okay.
And Adam Silver addressed that during his press conference, that that's one concern. Now, I'd still be a little surprised if, like, the NBA is going to expand. It's going to be because it wants to expand. You're not going to use that as a negotiating chip with the one-and-done thing because they view that as something the players want, not as, yes. Not as something they're bargaining for. So the other aspect, I mean, there was... When Seattle came up, it's more in the context of what's going to happen with teams in smaller markets whose futures are unsettled. His ownership is unsettled. Those being
teams who we may have discussed before.
Those being Memphis and New Orleans. And a lot of discussion about the Memphis buy-sell option, which still has yet to play out, but will be interesting.
Have the minority owners exerted that option?
They've exercised it, yes, but we don't know when it's actually going, when they'll actually have to name a price and when Robert Pera will have to decide whether to match that price or sell his shares at that price.
Okay.
But that is coming at some point.
So the state of Memphis is still in flux right now?
Very much in flux.
Interesting.
Yes.
I mean, I think that's... It's going to be something we have to pay a lot of attention to.
Oh, the other expansion thing, by the way, is that Louisville has formed... Louisville? I don't know how to pronounce it.
Bill Simmons mentioned that too, right? Or was that Tate who mentioned that?
I can't remember who first mentioned it, but that they have formed an expansion committee with Dan Issel involved, the legendary member of the Kentucky Colonels of the ABA.
Well, Dan Issel was involved.
As you pointed out, Louisville, not a substantially bigger market. I went and looked at the DMA. Memphis is 49. New Orleans is 50. Louisville's 51. They're all
It doesn't really pass the common sense test to me of if you're going to move a team from a quote-unquote smaller market like Memphis, why would you move them to another smaller market?
I mean, I think the one argument was that it would be that it's a more basketball-crazed region. Although Memphis...
It's the exact... region? Are they in a different region? Louisville and Memphis?
I think the state of Kentucky is different in terms of basketball. I don't know if you've heard,
but they're still relatively close.
I don't know if you've heard, they have a tradition of basketball there. They have some strong college programs, one of which plays in the arena in which the NBA team would play. So, I don't know. But while we're on the topic of expansion, we should probably discuss the latest development on the NHL front, which is that during Mayor Jenny Durkan's State of the City address on Tuesday, she announced a season ticket drive for NHL Seattle will start on March 1st at 10 a.m. They'll take refundable deposits both on the phone or they're encouraging people to do it through NHLSeattle.com. $500 for season tickets, $1,000 for club season tickets. And this was interesting. So I went to the website and checked out the FAQ on this. And if you look at what's the difference between season tickets and club season tickets, one thing they highlight is first priority access for club season ticket holders to select events at the renovated arena, including potential NBA club season tickets if an NBA team plays its home games at the renovated arena.
Interesting.
So it's, you know, it's nice to at least hear them talk about the NBA possibility in that context.
I mean, to me, the biggest, this is all, obviously it's all happening. Hockey's coming.
Unless things go horribly awry with the season ticket or drive.
Which is not going to happen. Look, things are going to go extremely well with the season ticket holder drive.
It seems overwhelmingly likely.
Like, I would put the chance at near zero that things go quote-unquote horribly awry. But
I would put it larger than zero.
Welcome to the podcast, baby fantasy genius. Babyest fantasy genius. Yes. When you're going to grow up, child, with a hockey team for your entire life.
Well, not entire life, but entire conscious life.
Hopefully you'll see an NBA team, though, because to me, I think seeing even this little nugget means that they're having the thought. They're maybe you're having conversations that people aren't, because the thing that I was worried about was the hockey player who's played for like 4 decades.
Jaromir Jagr?
Oh, yeah. He'll be on the team. Don't worry. The thing that worried me when seeing all this hockey talk was that people were getting complacent about basketball. We're losing sight of what the primary issue is here, and that's getting basketball back to Seattle. And so even seeing this little bit makes me feel a little bit better about it.
Yeah, Twitter does not seem... Sonics fans on Twitter do not seem to be getting complacent about things.
Does not feel that great about hockey.
An interesting NHL note. A report over the weekend on Hockey Night in Canada Saturday by Sportsnet's Nick Kyprios. Mm-hmm. No, that R is before the E. Nick Kyprios. Kyprios? Nick Kyprios. Let's go with that.
Can't even pronounce hockey names.
I mean, this is my first time saying it. That Detroit Red Wings GM Ken Holland, whose contract is up at the end of the season, could be a candidate for the Seattle job. And Kyprios
are the Red Wings good? That was my question.
Apparently they're not that good.
Oh, cool.
But they've been good in the past.
Oh, okay. Yeah. If I knew anything about hockey, I would have takes.
The analysis from Kyprios was that, quote, you've got to put him at the top of the list.
Wow.
So there you go. That's a possible candidate for GM for a team that does not currently exist.
We're going to be tracking this closely.
All right, on to the Seattle Sounders. We forgot to drink a toast earlier, by the way.
Ugh.
To the return, again officially, of Lamar Nagel, who re-signed as a free agent on Tuesday. After playing for the getting traded to the Sounders last year. It's just always good to have Lamar Nagel on the Sounders.
Is Brad Evans gone, though?
Brad Evans is sadly gone. He has signed with Sporting Kansas City.
We're both toasting to Lamar Nagel and to Brad Evans' tenure with the Sounders.
Yeah. Yeah. Give it up for Brad Evans, a member of a championship team, an MLS Cup winning team.
Was he
an original Sounder?
Sounder season? Yeah.
Yeah.
Man.
I think it's Osvaldo Alonso is who we're down to as far as original Sounders who have been around the whole time. So, the Sounders getting their season underway this week.
No, they're not.
That is true.
The regular season?
Not the regular season, but the CONCACAF Champions League this Thursday.
There's real soccer happening this
first
week.
Leg in El Salvador, the round of 16 versus Santa Tecla FC, having completed their preseason with a 3-1 win at Sacramento Republic FC last Thursday.
It's snowing outside.
who is it? Was it Costa Rica that had to play the game in the snow in Denver? Like, they'll tell you, sometimes you've got to play soccer in the snow. But also, I'm pretty sure it's not snowing right now in El Salvador, where the Sounders will be playing. The return leg is next Thursday, which will be followed by the MLS season opener a week from Sunday, March 4th.
God.
Against LAFC, which I saw some LAFC paraphernalia, like some gear down there in LA. So people are aware of them. I also saw this. You can see the stadium right from I-5. So saw that as well.
Well,
or maybe that's the
So the season is starting a week from Sunday.
Yep.
The MLS regular season.
Yes.
Jesus Christ.
It's not a joke. The MLS season is super long. It is a joke, but it's not a joke.
I mean, it doesn't end that much sooner than the NFL regular season ends, right?
Like that much earlier?
That much earlier.
I mean,
it's like a couple weeks.
But the MLS regular season? I mean, the MLS regular season ends in like October, but then the playoffs last in like a month and a half.
Okay, the playoffs are just really long.
I mean, everything is really long.
And maybe we're kind of fortunate enough for the season to have been even longer.
That is true.
For the
it's
Sounders.
Not as long for a lot of teams.
We've got a long time to go before the Seahawks regular season starts, though.
We do. We'll get to their offseason in a second here. The Sounders traveling to El Salvador without midfielder Osvaldo Alonso is still recovering from last year's quad strain that kept him out of the MLS Cup final. Right back Kelvin Leerdam has a sprained ankle he suffered during the preseason and is out a couple weeks. And then center back Roman Torres, I almost called him quarterback when I read that CBA there, has a sore leg. Also, Victor Rodriguez is being eased back
in. We're
in
off-season mode.
Gustav Svensson missed the Sacramento match with a personal matter, so he's behind in his training. And newcomer Magnus Wolf Ikram still finalizes his visa, so it's unclear whether he can play in El Salvador. So the Sounders are going to need to get creative with their lineup this week. Brian Schmetzer, I think the goal is to try to get a draw this week. One option potentially to replace Leerdam. Last week, the Sounders signed right back Jordan McCrary, who was the number 10 overall pick by New England in the 2016 MLS Super Draft, was released after that season without making an appearance for the Revolution, and spent last season with Toronto FC 2. So he'll be in the mix at right back, along with, you know, potentially you could slide someone in from another position, like Jordy Delem has played there,
yeah.
Even Christian Roldan, maybe Alex Roldan, although I think that you probably don't want to throw him right out there.
Be starting at left back.
Probably. Another option is you could play Nuhu and Waylon Francis and have two left-footed outside backs. So we'll see what Brian Schmetzer comes up with.
Uncomfortable visually.
It is. Also in Sounders news, they're reportedly set to sign South Korean center back Kim Ki-hee, who was playing with Obafemi Martins for Shanghai Shenhao FC, which needs to free up an international spot, similar to how the Sounders got Gustav Svensson last year when they changed their the Chinese league changed their rules on the number of international players you're allowed. He transferred from the Korean league for $6 million in 2016,
really?
Which was reported as the biggest transfer in Korean history, and won a bronze medal for South Korea in 2012 Olympics at age 28, still at the tail end of his prime.
All right.
So this is not finalized yet, but it sounds like he's probably going to be joining the Sounders to add some more depth at that center back position, where right now they really only have Tony Alfaro behind the two starters. So speaking of the Seahawks and their offseason, which is going to last many months before the NFL season starts in September, Tuesday was the start of a 15-day period where teams can apply the transition or franchise tags to their free agents. Sheldon Richardson is the most likely Seahawks candidate. Joel Corey of CBSSports.com projects the non-exclusive franchise tag for defensive tackles will be $14.2 million, somewhere in that range. That's a one-year tender offer, and then teams traditionally negotiate a longer offer using the leverage of that franchise tag. Technically, because it's not exclusive, other teams are allowed to make offers to that player, but they must surrender two first-round picks if the original team declines to match. And according to the NFL Media Research Group via Andrew Siciliano, that has not happened since 1998.
Who was that in 1998?
I believe it was Sean Gilbert.
If you're right about that, I'm going to be very...
Well, I mean, it was in the tweet.
Okay.
I just didn't write that down in my notes. Jimmy Graham is also eligible, would be a $10 million salary projected for a tight end as a franchise tag, but that seems kind of unlikely at this point. The Seahawks have not made much use of the franchise or transition tags. They last used the franchise tag on Olindo Mare in 2010. That's the only time it's happened on John Schneider's watch.
One time in the PCJS.
As you can imagine, the franchise tag for a kicker is not as expensive as it is for a defensive
back. What do you make of that amount for Sheldon Richardson?
Well, obviously you can't pay Sheldon Richardson $14.2 million this season.
He's not coming back then.
But, I mean, the idea would be you use that as leverage to sign a longer-term deal at a more reasonable amount. That brings us to, should we discuss quickly Bill Barnwell's offseason?
Okay, so we talked about this last year, and I felt like it was kind of divisive.
It was a source of some controversy, including with Bill Barnwell himself. All right, here's his five things the Seahawks should do.
I think we might make amends with Barnwell this year.
I mean, I do disagree with one thing that's on here. Number one, free up cap space by waiving Cliff Averill and Jeremy Lain, which I think we can all say we pretty much expect. Number two, work on re-signing Sheldon Richardson, but be prepared to let him leave.
Yep.
Barnwell suggests that, you know, anything in the double-digit millions of dollars is probably too much for Richardson, at which point I think you're probably losing him.
They're losing him.
You're more certain of this than I am. I'm not certain of it.
I just think that market is going to be huge for Sheldon Richardson.
Number three, re-sign their Hall of Famers to extensions, notably Earl Thomas. He also mentions Dwayne Brown, who is not likely a Hall of Famer, but also intriguingly suggests considering an extension now for Russell Wilson, who has 2 years left on his deal.
Is that the thing you disagree with?
It's the thing I do.
Because you want to trade Russell?
Yes, yes, that's it. What if we get Drew Brees? I think it's a reasonable consideration. I think there is zero chance. So Barnwell's argument is that it makes sense to do it now because the market will only continue escalating for quarterbacks, and then the Seahawks can manipulate Wilson's cap hit.
Okay.
So I think there's zero chance of it happening.
It's not a strong disagreement, though.
I think it might be a good idea, but I think the Seahawks have taken the position that they will not renegotiate the contracts of players with more than 1 year remaining. And I think the reason they won't do it is they believe it's worth the risk of paying Russell Wilson more to be able to say to players with 2 years left on your contract, we are not going to do this. We won't do this for anyone.
Yes, including Russell Wilson.
It's kind of like why Jeff Van Gundy hates the 2-for-1. Like, he doesn't like the idea of taking a bad shot in any situation, even if it's a better play in that one moment, because he thinks it's like a bad long-term idea.
Okay. Where do you stand on the idea of trying to re-sign Earl Thomas, though?
I think the Seahawks should do it.
Of course.
I don't like this trade talk at all. I talked with Mina Kimes over the weekend, my ESPN colleague and third Pelton brother.
I think, who was she of the Seahawks secondary?
I can't remember. I think she was Sherman, right?
She was Sherman.
I mean, it makes sense. I think I was Earl Thomas.
Okay, well, obviously you don't like this idea.
She said that, like, I can't remember what her expression was for the Earl Thomas trade talk, but she was a hard pass on that.
Okay.
As I think we both are.
I mean, I'm 100% on board for all three of these. I mean, the thing is, we'll get to 4 and 5 in a second, but, like, obviously they should work on re-signing Sheldon Richardson. He's a very good and effective player.
They shouldn't ghost him. They shouldn't new phone who dis.
It's just that the prices, I think, is going to be very significant for Sheldon Richardson.
Yeah, yeah. All right, number four, wait to re-sign Frank Clark. Barnwell's position is the Seahawks are, quote, unlikely to get much of a discount and should take advantage of Clark's small cap hit in 2018.
Yeah.
Sure, that seems reasonable. He also points out that many of the defensive ends of Clark's ilk who have signed long-term deals have done so after being hit with the franchise tag. So that's a possibility for next year.
So it could be that, and if Frank Clark makes a little bit, how old is Sheldon Richardson vis-a-vis Frank Clark?
He's at least probably
also an interior lineman with Malik McDowell kind of lurking.
Well, is Malik Dell lurking?
Lurking.
I think that's one of the big questions of the Seahawks offseason is whether he's lurking or not. It's interesting, by the way, I just went to Wikipedia and put in Seattle, and the Sonics are still like the fourth option on there, ahead of the Mariners, ahead of the Sounders.
There we go.
Behind only the Seahawks. So shouts to the Sonics. Hashtag never forget.
Mariners spring training started and did not get a mention.
We didn't have any hot takes about it.
The hot takes will come later.
Let's see here. Sheldon Richardson is under unrestricted free agents, and he is 27 years old.
He's pretty young, all things considered.
He is pretty young, all things considered. Frank Clark is 24.
Okay, so Frank Clark is very young.
Yes, which is why Frank Clark is going to get paid.
And I think Frank Clark being an edge rusher versus Sheldon Richardson being more of an interior player. A good pass rusher, though. But
he wasn't last year. I mean, one of the things that ESPN's Brady Henderson has been pointing out is if the Seahawks do bring Richardson back, it's surely with the thought that he will be more impactful as a pass rusher with an additional year of experience is a 4-3 defensive tackle.
Cool.
You're like ready to drive Sheldon Richardson to the airport.
Not ready to drive Sheldon Richardson to the airport. I think the Seahawks should try to resign him. But for Frank Clark, the difference in their value in this offseason, next offseason versus this offseason for Sheldon, is so significant.
I don't know if it's so significant, but it's
where it makes sense that we probably will not see the Seahawks franchise a player this offseason. And I think next offseason, if they don't re-sign Frank Clark, I think that we will see the Seahawks franchise.
There's a lot of people
player.
Who think that he will be franchised Sheldon Richardson. You need to assign a higher Bayesian probability.
No, I'm not
saying
it's impossible.
But who if they should have franchised in that time? Like, who is the biggest Seahawks unrestricted free agent? They've extended all their own good players.
Bruce Irvin.
I mean, yeah. Brandon Browner? I don't know. They haven't let these guys get to free agency.
They let Kurse get to free agency and no mention of him.
He was restricted, I think, at the time. He was not unrestricted. With Clark, I mean, I think the other thing is, like, obviously you can have conversations with this agent about what it would take to extend him, and you don't have, you're under no requirement to do it now.
Yes. But I do like the idea of using the small cap hit for one more year.
Right. All right, the last thing on Barnwell's list, acquire a tight end to replace Jimmy Graham. And he moots the possibility of taking a flyer on Tyler Eifert, who would probably be a similar kind of red zone target if he could stay healthy, or trading for restricted free agent Cameron Brate from the Tampa Bay Buccaneers.
Why are we mooting those possibilities?
Those are possibilities.
Oh, wait. Tell me what the word moot means.
It's like, consider? suggest.
Moot means like don't consider, like it's a moot issue. That's you know what I mean?
That's in a different context.
Oh.
That's not a, that's just an adjective.
Good thing you have an English degree.
So is an adjective. It's subject to debate, dispute, or uncertainty, and typically not admittee of a final decision. That seems like the opposite of the way that term is used. But as a verb, it's to raise a question or topic for discussion, suggest an idea or possibility.
All right. No.
I think those are the exact two word terms I use.
All right, I like it. Tyler Effort being injury prone is a little bit concerning. Cameron Brate, though. I could be into Cameron Brate.
I mean, it depends how much you have to give up, because you both giving up draft pick compensation and paying him at that point. Another person who's likely to get a lot of mention is Seth Burton, who would probably come in and start at quarterback.
Wait, what?
He threw the touchdown.
Oh, I don't. Seth Burton?
Am I misremembering? Is it Trey Burton?
Trey Burton?
Is that who I'm thinking of?
I don't know. I've never heard of
Eagles
Seth
tight
Burton.
End. Who threw the touchdown?
He threw the touchdown to Nick Foles?
Yes.
His name was Seth Burton.
No, his name is definitely Trey Burton.
Yeah, okay.
but you didn't recognize that name either.
I think I was probably more likely to recognize Trey Burton, but not on the same level as Cameron Brate or something like Tyler Eifert.
And probably going to get paid a lot of money. I would like. By the way, Seth Burton, LAFC, is director of communications, vice president of communications.
That's
he used to work for the Clippers.
That's what you were talking about.
It actually was who I was talking about.
Wait, really?
He used to work for the Clippers PR. All right, but. I mean, yes, I think we all agree that Jimmy Graham is unlikely to return.
The Seahawks are either going to have to spend, I don't think that they could go into next season with the tight ends that they have on the roster. It wouldn't be the end of the world. But I think what's most likely is they bring in either a player like in this caliber, or they spend a draft pick on a tight end.
Yep. All right, let's wrap up with UW Sports here. Women's basketball dropped to 1-15 in conference play with two losses by a combined 55 points at Colorado and Utah over the weekend. Their worst record for the Huskies in the Pac-10/12 era is 3-15 in 2008-09 under Tia Jackson, so they need to win both games this weekend to match that. Unfortunately, the bad news is they finished by hosting number 16 Stanford and Cal this weekend. Stanford is 13-3, still hoping to catch 14-2 Oregon for first place in the conference before the Pac-12 women's basketball tournament at Kearney next the weekend after this, which I will be attending. Cal is 9-7 in conference play, so Huskies going to have to pull an upset to win either of these two games. Uh-huh. In bad, happier news.
Sort of.
UW softball has moved up to number one in the country.
Oh! I was not expecting that.
In the coaches' poll, they're number one in the country after off their 12-0 start. They had a 46-inning shutout streak at one point. They are still third in the USA softball poll. We'll learn a little more. Yeah, haters. We'll learn a little more about the Husky softball team this weekend when they play in the Mary Nutter Classic in Palm Springs against, among others, undefeated number 6 Texas A&M.
This is a team
Saturday.
That I've been following for literally moments, but I am shocked and appalled at the hate.
Are you going to air a grievance with the butters?
At the USA Today poll, I mean, this is clearly the number one team in the country. I mean, they've been the number one team in the country since I found out they were good literally moments ago.
I mean, you knew they were good last year. You watched some of the Women's College World Series, didn't you?
Yeah, Dan LaLaurie, she was great.
Oh, no.
They were not this good, though.
No, they were not this good. They were maybe like third in the country.
Yeah, let's talk about Husky basketball.
All right, last weekend, the Huskies, a very mixed weekend. Similar to kind of the Isaiah Thomas jersey retirement. It getting postponed on Thursday. That was a rough night for those of us who had expected to see Isaiah Thomas's jersey retirement, and also those of us who had hoped to see a Husky win because they lost 70-58 to Utah. But Saturday, when Isaiah Thomas's jersey was retired with him wearing a purple blazer, the Huskies destroyed Colorado 82-59 for their biggest win in conference play in a couple years.
So, can we talk about Thursday night for 1 second?
Of course.
That sucked.
Yeah, it wasn't great.
Just I mean, everything about
the Huskies
it.
Huskies were up 8 at the half, and it looked like, okay, maybe this team is good again.
Yeah, I kind of thought they were going to just cruise to a victory at that point.
But it turns out that Utah is a terrible matchup for the zone.
Well, I said to you at halftime, and I probably shouldn't have done this, granted. I was like, the Huskies are getting very lucky. because Utah was shooting really badly at that point.
I immediately told you not to say anything.
I mean, it was going to happen. Like, there was nothing that I could have done to stop it. And then Utah, in the second half started, and immediately Utah just looked like the better team.
Well, they just ran off three threes in a row, and we saw the same thing as Oregon State. When that happens, all of a sudden the zone stretches out, and there's a wide swath of
open looks,
land
though.
In the middle.
They weren't missing good threes. Utah was able to exploit the zone in a way that I don't think I've really seen all year. I was impressed with Larry Krasobiec.
He's a very good coach.
It reminded me almost of when Montana almost pulled off that 16-1 upset.
Under Coach K?
Yeah.
He's an excellent coach. He has NBA experience. So, and what stood out was Utah's patience against the zone.
Yeah.
And then they just destroyed the offensive glass when they did miss shots in the second half.
Big man, whatever his name is.
Well, they have a few of them. None of whom I can remember off the top of my head.
Yeah, but he really, really destroyed the Huskies. But that was a game where it just felt lifeless, you know? People were expecting Isaiah's jersey to be retired, and instead they get a 6 o'clock start against Utah.
Yeah.
In a game where the Huskies can't score.
David Collette, I think, was...
It was Collette, yeah.
He was perfect from the field in that game, right?
Oh, God. He really, really...
Oh, not quite. He was 8 of 10 from the field. Also 6 of 6 from the free throw line for 22 points. And then also important in this, I thought, was their power forward, Tyler Rawson, who was playing that role at the high post where you're really a crucial decision maker against the zone. He had 15 points, 11 rebounds, and 5 assists.
They had a very good second half. And at that point, we're kind of just like, you know what? Maybe the Huskies are bad.
But then, just when we thought that I thought I was out, they brought me back in again.
They really did.
A game that you did not see.
The power was out here. Just like the power was out when you didn't see the Arcade Fire. You didn't see Win Butler, the celebrity game.
Okay.
You know, the song, Power's Out.
Oh.
Anyway.
It fell flat like the Huskies' second half.
Wow.
Or like Fergie's national anthem. That was too harsh. What were you going to say?
A game where all of the energy that wasn't there on Thursday was there on Saturday. We had Markel Fultz in the building. We had Marquise Chris in the building. Isaiah Thomas obviously getting his jersey retired. And the one wrinkle of not having the jersey retirement on Thursday is Low Row in the building, there to support Isaiah. He's almost like honorary Husky coach. Like when they showed the highlights of him kind of congratulating Dominic Green after beating Arizona, I was like, is there something in Lorenzo that was like, God, I hope the Huskies win this game? I wonder if there was any part of him that was cheering for that shot to go in. I feel like deep down inside, Lorenzo wanted that shot to go in.
I don't think there was any part of him that wanted it to go in, but I think it hurt less because of the fact that it was someone he recruited. Let's call Lorenzo Husky coach emeritus.
Yeah. Sean Miller's like plucking his voodoo doll. Lorenzo was happy that happened, at least a little bit.
So the Huskies, as a net result of those two games, are still more or less the same spot in RPI at this point, currently standing 46th. They have slipped a little in terms of the bracket projections. ESPN's Joe Lunardi, both ESPN's Joe Lunardi and CBS's Jerry Palm have them in the first four out. They differ on the other Pac-12 teams where they rank. Lunardi has UCLA and USC both also in the first four out, so three of the four are Pac-12 teams, with Utah then in the next four out, whereas Palm has UCLA and USC both in, and Utah in the first four out. So either way, there are a lot of Pac-12 teams on the bubble who could go either way over the last 2 weeks of the regular season.
The bubble is
Pac-12
huge
tournament.
In the Pac-12.
Yes. So that makes this an important weekend for the Huskies in the Bay.
Yes.
First off, they face Stanford, who is tied with UW right now for fifth in the Pac-12 at 8-6. They're both part of a projected three-way tie for fifth, along with Arizona State at 10-8, according to the KenPom mean projections. Now, this isn't necessarily a must-win, because the Huskies do, even if they lose this, have a clearer path to 11-7, because Stanford finishes with Arizona and Arizona State on the road next weekend, so those are probably both going to be losses. The Cardinal have been fifth in the Pac-12 in efficiency margin. The Huskies are ninth, but have no chance at an NCAA tournament bid because they went 6-7 in non-conference, including losses to Eastern Washington, Long Beach State, and Portland State, and they also lost to Cal, which may as well have been a bad non-conference loss. Because Cal was worse than...
They lost to Cal?
Cal is worse than all three of those teams.
I shouldn't speak too soon.
Well, we'll get to that in a second. So, Stanford... beat the Huskies in Seattle, one of two teams to do so far this year. And I guess I would say I think probably the Huskies' worst loss of the year in terms of just the quality of the opponent.
Okay.
And where the game
even worse than Utah. Those are the only two losses they have at home, right?
Utah's a much better team than Stanford.
Okay.
Overall. So why did the Cardinal win that game? They dominated the glass. They had 14 offensive rebounds to just 3 for the Huskies. And that's something we can probably expect to continue. The Huskies have been terrible in terms of defensive rebounding. And for Stanford, both Reed Travis and Michael Humphrey, their starting front court, both top 20 in the conference in offensive rebounding. Also, the Huskies went 5 of 22 on threes in that game, including 1 of 7 from David Crisp. Meanwhile, Stanford, who rarely shoots threes, took just 11 of them in that game and made 4 of them. So the Huskies, you know, ability to zone away the three-pointer really wasn't that important against Stanford.
Huh.
And then the Cardinal, with their size in the front court, limited Noah Dickerson to 8 points on 2 of 7 shooting. And really, this game could have been worse for the Huskies because Stanford shot 15 of 29 from the foul line, although they're not great foul shooters overall. They're 11th in Pac-12.
Because they have a lot of big men.
Yes. And also, their starting small forward, Kizzy Okapala, is a dreadful free throw shooter and just not really an outside threat at all.
Did they ever do the Hakka in college?
I heard that it might have happened to, I believe it was Marquette Center earlier this year, or someone like that. But it's very infrequent.
Okay.
The Huskies sort of did it once to Hamidi Njai. Is that the... No, the 7 foot Mamadou Njai.
That was a long time ago, Mamadou Njai.
7'6" center for UC Santa Barbara. We've also been tracking Dejon Davis, who is number 3 in conference in assist rate and has reined in his turnovers. He's only averaging 3.4 per game in Pac-12 play after pushing 5 in the non-conference schedule. So
he's looking good.
He's giving them productive play.
He's one of the better freshmen in the Pac-12 outside of DeAndre Ayton.
And Jalen Noah. I mean, there's some good freshmen in the conference this year. Obviously, Troy Brown at Oregon has been terrific.
What about Cal?
So Cal has won just twice in conference play, including that win at Stanford and then Oregon State. And those two have come by a combined 7 points. They do have 2 close losses in their last 3 games at Colorado and then home against Stanford last week. But overall, they are very bad. An interesting thing, I mentioned that UW is 9th in the Pac-12 in efficiency differential. The thing is, they've still outscored their opponents. It's just that there are 9 teams in the Pac-12 with positive differentials because the 3 bad teams in the Pac-12 are that bad. Colorado is getting outscored by 12.8 points per 100 possessions in Pac-12 play. Wazoo is minus 16.5, and Cal is minus 19.1 points per 100 possessions in Pac-12 play.
When the Huskies need to be undefeated against those teams.
Yes. Now, part of what's happened is Cal has, stop me for this before, had horrendous luck on opponent three-point shooting. They're making more than 40% of their threes.
Be prepared for regress this weekend.
In conference play. The good news for the Huskies, and why I think this is a terrific matchup, is Cal cannot shoot at all. They are dead last in the conference in three-point percentage, and 344th in the nation overall for the season. They are 343rd in three-point attempt rate. Oh, and they're also dead last in two-point percentage in conference play. Oh, and as if that wasn't bad enough, being last in the conference in three-point percentage by opponents, they're 11th in opponent two-point percentage, despite playing a lot of big men. So they're a very bad basketball team.
Cal's bad.
One thing they do particularly well is they are effective offensive rebounders, and that's going to be an issue for the Huskies in this game. They also get to the free throw line a lot, which probably won't be as much of an issue against the zone. Their best player, Marcus Lee, played just 17 minutes at UW due to foul trouble. Their leading scorer, Don Coleman, was also limited by foul trouble at UW to 14 minutes, but he is decidedly not their best player, as he is shooting just 38% on twos and 28% on threes this year and is notably inefficient. So, bottom line is, this is a game, you don't have to win it to make the NCAA tournament, but you have to win it to make the NCAA tournament.
They have to win the Cal game. They don't have to win the weekend. They have to win the Cal game.
They have to split, yeah. I mean,
the Cal game's a must win.
Beating Stanford would give them the inside track to finishing 5th in the conference and put them in position to maybe get back in the race for one of the byes in the first round, get a top 4 seed in the Pac-12 tournament. So that would be very nice.
What do you think percentage chances of victory are first against Stanford?
I think about 30%.
Okay, and then against Cal?
So KenPom says 70%. I mean, home court is a big factor in conference play. I still think that's too low. I think at least 75%.
Really?
Yeah, I just...
Cal's bad.
And they're bad in ways that won't work well against UW, I don't think.
A win on Thursday against Stanford would be huge.
It would be huge, yeah. No other way to put it.
I mean, the Huskies, given the loss they had at Utah, given the tough loss against Oregon State, need to pull one of these out.
Right. I mean, you could say that Arizona State was an example of them pulling one of these out, let alone Arizona, but...
Ancient history at this point.
I mean, I think if they finish 3-1 to end the conference season, they'll be in good shape, but you can't take for granted...
What is their record right now? How many conference wins?
8-6. 8-6.
So if they can get to 11 wins, you think they'd feel pretty good?
Yeah.
But, you know, those Oregon games are not a given.
No.
They're at home, but they're not a given.
Nope.
And Oregon presented a particular problem for the Huskies defensively.
They had a particular set of skills.
Oregon's a scary team, and I would really prefer if you have one loss that you can have in your back pocket, I'd rather it be Oregon than Stanford.
Sure, certainly that is preferable.
So, this is a big weekend.
It is. All right. Well, on that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.